Well, as you see on our screen, we have our new series title that will lead us right up until Easter, and it is For the Joy That Is Set Before Him, For the Joy That Is Set Before Him. And so we're going to be taking you all the way up until Easter Sunday with our next series. And in accordance with 2022 being a year of spiritual formation, we want to continue to follow this discipleship theme that we have to be with Jesus, to be like Jesus, and to do what Jesus did. And so for the first few months, we focused a lot on being with Jesus. We focused on silence and solitude and prayer and listening to God and meditation of Scripture last week. And so now we want to move into this time of exploring the character qualities of Jesus and just observing who was this man so that we can become formed in the likeness of Jesus. And so we're going to look at some stories in the coming weeks that will take us right up until Easter, and specifically asking us this question: what is Jesus like, and what can we take away from that story? So as the writer of Hebrews says, because of the joy set before him, he endured the cross. So as Jesus is making his way to the cross, we're going to join him and observe his life. Well, today I want to jump into John 12, and that is where our passage is going to be today. I invite you to turn to your Bibles if you have it with you or your devices, but we'll also have it on the screen as well. Now, to give you a little bit of context before we jump into this story, things are really stirring up in the surrounding areas of Jerusalem. So what just happened is Jesus just performed a pretty significant miracle. He raised a dead man to life, so no small thing. That happened in chapter 11, and as you can imagine, a miracle like that is starting to really stir things up, and this Jesus of Nazareth movement is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And guess what? The chief priests and the religious leaders of the time don't like that at all. Well, why? Because they're afraid that if things are too disruptive, that Rome will look at it and say, well, we're just going to take your temple back and your nation back because things are in uproar. So they feel a little bit threatened. And the timing of this takes place about a week before Passover. And if you're familiar with Passover, it is a Jewish festival. And if you are a good Jew, you're going to make your way to Jerusalem and observe that festival. And so the chief priests and leaders know that, and they assume, hey, if we want to get Jesus, if we want to arrest him and kill him, this is a good time to be aware and on the lookout for him. So Jesus' life is in jeopardy. And if you're Jesus, what do you think you would do at this point? Well, he decides to go have a dinner party. Counterintuitive, like Jesus always does, right? So he makes his way to Bethany to have a dinner party with some friends, and that is where we're going to pick up today. So John 12, verse 1. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. And I also want to mention, we are going to learn that Mary was there as well. But just to make a few observations about this text so far. Number one, we are in Bethany, and Bethany is only a few miles outside of Jerusalem. Okay, so Jesus is making his way there, and he's making his way there, as I've already said, because he knows his time is coming to an end. And this is the place where Lazarus was raised from the dead. And so guess what? Lazarus, Martha, and Mary, and they're all siblings, decide to throw him a dinner party. Because you know what? If you just raised your brother from the dead, why not? So they're having this party. And if you recall, there are some other stories in the Gospels that tell us a little bit more about these characters that I just wanted to highlight a little bit that I think that will help us understand more of the story and what's going on. So if you recall, Mary and Martha, in one of the stories, was having another time with Jesus and having a meal with him. And Martha wanted to serve and to be busy about, just like she is in this story. And Mary is not helping her sister. Instead, she is at the feet of Jesus, and she is enjoying listening to him and learning from him. Now, you can imagine, observing some siblings, what just might happen. Martha begins to complain to Jesus and say, "Will you tell my sister to help me? I'm doing all the work." And his reply to her probably surprised her, and he said, "Martha, Martha, 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 you are concerned about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen the better portion, and it will not be taken away from her." So what is he saying? He's saying, "Martha, I'm not saying that serving me is bad or being busy, but Mary is actually choosing the most important thing right now, and that is being with me and learning from me." So right away there, you see Mary and her spirit to just want to be with Jesus, and that's a beautiful thing. In her other story that I've already mentioned, Lazarus becomes sick, and word is sent to Jesus to come, and it says, "Lazarus, the one whom you love is sick. Please come quickly." Well, Jesus delays, and he gets there after Lazarus is dead. So everyone is mourning and crying. And Martha and Mary eventually meet Jesus outside, and they both kind of have this similar response, and they say, "Jesus, if you would have been here, my brother wouldn't have died." And maybe you can resonate with that today, of wondering sometimes, "Jesus, where were you? Like, if you would have showed up for me, this thing that I was afraid of wouldn't have happened." And so they have a very honest confrontational moment. And like Jesus, he's able to teach them a few things and see their heart. So needless to say, Mary's perspective and posture towards Jesus has been shaped and has been impacted through these different stories that we are available to see in the Gospels. And you're probably wondering in verse 3 that we're about to look at. Let me read it first, and then we'll comment on it. Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume, and she poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. Weird. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. So you read that and you think, this is odd, and why is Jesus letting a woman wipe his feet with her hair and perfume? This isn't a custom we do in America. Let's just be real about that. So it is perplexing. Well, let me shed a little bit of light on this. First of all, we find out that it is a pint of pure nard, expensive perfume. Now, this weekend I thought I would look up, just Google some fun expensive perfumes out there. And I found that some names of perfumes have a little bit more of a soft, elegant ring to them, like Chanel or J'adore Dior. I practiced that. That might not be very good if we have any French speakers in here today. But that's a million miles away from nard. Ladies, you know, if you go to your girlfriend, "Wow, you smell good. What are you wearing?" Nard. Not quite nice as Chanel. Maybe nard. Okay, so I just found that was humorous. But it's an expensive perfume, and most likely this is an heirloom. So this is something that Mary has been having for quite a while. And nard is kept in alabaster bottles, and it is sealed for the intensive purposes of preventing evaporation. So in order for you to get it out, you have to actually break the neck of the bottle. And once you break the neck of the bottle, I mean, all the perfume is expanded all at once. And so it's like, you better decide if you want to open this thing or not, because it's kind of an all or nothing thing here. Now, to get to the whole the act of actually putting the nard on Jesus, culturally what's going on here, it's a profound act of honor and respect of what she is doing. And the symbolism of her being at his feet is like symbolizing a lowly place, a place for her of humility. Now, also what's going on here that I need to acknowledge is that in that day, for a woman to let down her hair is kind of a provocative gesture. It could be interpreted that way, that maybe she's a woman of loose morals, or maybe she's making an advance at Jesus. But let me assure you, that's not what's happening here. That's not what's happening. Anointing was a custom in festivals, and it was also something that would just signify celebration or revelry. And at the same time, this perfume is really potent. And so we read here that the house was filled with the fragrance, the whole house, not just this little area, but it is now moving its way into the entire house. So it's like straight up smelling like Sephora or Bath and Body Works in there, or like a spa, okay? So Mary's act is now like consuming the senses of everybody that is at the party. And so then we're wondering, okay, well, how is this going to go down? Remarkably, Jesus doesn't stop Mary from the gesture. In fact, this becomes more and more impressive as we find out how much it is worth. Let's continue reading in verse 4. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. A year's wages! Imagine taking your whole household income for a year, put it in the form of a gift, and can you imagine giving that to someone you love? Or maybe an heirloom that you've been holding on to for years, passed down to generations? I mean, that is an act of generosity that I just don't have a category for. I don't have a category for that. But to Mary, Jesus was worth it to her. And that gesture made Judas super angry, and angry for all the wrong reasons, in which John is ready to let us in on why. So let's go to the next verse. John busts Judas here. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put in it. That doesn't give you a little more insight into the heart of Judas Iscariot. So look, Judas was actually the treasurer of the disciples' funds. And the writer, John here, now that he's writing years later, he totally busts Judas out in the story, and he's basically saying, Judas didn't care about the poor. Don't let that fool you. He didn't care about the poor. He's just missing out on stealing more money. Homeboy is not goody-goody or godly. He is greedy through and through. And isn't it interesting that sometimes the person that is most corrupt in a room is actually the one who's trying to act the most self-righteous? So now we're wondering, okay, how is Jesus going to respond to this whole scene unfolding? What does he do? Let's read in verse 7. Jesus says, "Leave her alone. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial." Huh, interesting. "You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." Now, if this scene isn't already odd, Jesus' comment about his burial further makes it even more perplexing. And it's like, what is he talking about? Well, first of all, he defends Mary, so that's pretty cool. And he puts Judas in his place. And basically saying, Judas, I mean, come on. We both know, you and I don't care about the poor, but I'm just going to play along with you. And if you do care about the poor, listen, you're always going to have them around. But as for me, my time is limited and my death is imminent. And this anointing is to symbolize my burial. Talk about a real mood killer in the middle of a celebration dinner. This thing is increasing tension, and you're beginning to see how the characters are experiencing this moment. So there's tension inside of the house. And I also want to draw attention to now the tension is building outside of the house. And John writes this, "Meanwhile, so at the same time, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him." Isn't this Jesus' life? I mean, crowds are constantly following everywhere. He probably just wants to get, you know, just some quiet, special time, build some memory with some friends before he heads into the final week. And crowds just won't leave him alone. And I don't blame them. They want to see this guy that was in a tomb for 4 days and was raised from the dead, and they actually want to see the guy who did it. So we can understand that, but guess who's not happy about it at all? Again, the chief priests, because they're part of a bigger religious establishment, and they collaborate with Rome. And guess what they really, really, really enjoy that they don't want to give up? Power, privilege, and status. So anything that's going to threaten their place, they have no patience for, and there's no middle ground here. So we're seeing just how polarizing Jesus continues to be in culture. And so now, not only is Jesus the miracle worker a threat, but also Lazarus, the living proof of the miracle, is also a threat. And so the chief priests and leaders are like, you know what, we just got to wipe them all out. They all have to go. And they wanted Jesus dead. Now, here's what I find ironic, is that they never would have imagined in a million years that this is actually what Jesus was going to choose for himself. Jesus knew where he was headed. He knew he was headed to die. Okay, so now, we know what's going on outside of the house and in the greater area, and we know that the chief priests are thinking. When we're inside of the house, we know what Judas is thinking. And we can have a pretty good idea of what Mary is thinking, and that she is just in this place of wanting to give her devotion and express how much she truly loves and appreciates Jesus. But what about Jesus? How is he experiencing all of this? Well, I want to dive a little bit deeper into verse 11. So we read again. He replies, "Leave her alone. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." You see, Jesus sees Mary's gift to him as way, way, way more significant than what she intended. And to her, this was a significant gift. So I'm not downplaying that at all. But to Jesus, this was deeply symbolic. Do you think Mary had a clue about this? I don't think so. I think unwittingly, this was just what she felt led to do, and she did it. She was simply performing an act of devotion for that time and something that was common in Jewish custom. But in the eyes of Jesus, she was performing a custom for his upcoming burial. Why? Because you see, in less than a week, he would be convicted as a criminal. And in that time, if you're convicted as a criminal, you are denied Jewish custom of being anointed the common oils and spices before your burial. So in other words, I don't want you to miss this. I don't want you to miss this. Jesus is seeing a far greater purpose in her action than she intended. A far greater purpose than what she intended. And isn't that like God? Isn't that like God to arrange circumstances and situations where to one person it might mean one thing, but then to the receiver it might mean something totally different? So I have a question for you. Have you ever given something to someone and you kind of meant it to mean one way, but then you find out later that it meant like the world to them? It had a really deeper, deeper significance. I got a story for you. 7 years ago, when I was living in Omaha, I led a class on Sundays, and it became a really sweet community of people. And during that time, there was a young woman who began to attend, and the class just welcomed her in and began to befriend her, and we found out that she had a pretty hard life, but we didn't really know many details about that. Well, we continued to be her friend, and unfortunately, found out that she had been diagnosed with lung cancer. And so we just wanted to love her well and just be a place where she felt the kindness and love of Jesus. Well, we found out somehow that it was her birthday coming up. And we thought, we should throw her a birthday party. That would be really cool. And we just prayed and prayed that she would have the strength from the chemo and that we would just catch her on a good day so that she could attend her birthday party. And so we did what a lot of us do when we throw a birthday party. You know, you get some good food, you get cake, you get balloons, flowers, little gifts, gift bags, cards, all the things. And she was able to come. And it's a celebration day I'll never forget. And at the end, I think we wore her out because she fell asleep, actually. And so we just let her rest, and guess the party's over. But we kind of thought she had a good time. Well, I found out a week later, I got an email, and it was from her care nurse. And it was a super long email that my friend had dictated to her, because my friend couldn't write. And then the nurse began to relay this thank you letter. And guess what? That was the first birthday party this young woman had ever had in her whole life. And she was 35 years old. The first one. She had never known in her life what it meant to be celebrated, and what I found out later, to even have one friend she could trust. I remember her sharing with me, she says, the fact I fell asleep there meant that I felt peace and safety. And if that doesn't tell you a little bit about her background, I don't know what does. What we thought was a simple gesture of just throwing her a party ended up meaning the absolute world to her. And I think this is a lot of what this story is showing us, that this case with Mary and Jesus, Mary's doing one gesture, but to Jesus, this means so much more to him, because it's pointing to the very act of love that he wants to do for all of humanity. Mary had no idea the significance of this gesture, except that it was generous. And even in the eyes of the others watching, you read in other Gospels in Mark, the disciples were right on board with Judas as far as saying, I think that's a wrong thing to do. We could do a whole lot more with that, Mary. And it says, in fact, that they were indignant. They were indignant, meaning that is just not the right thing to do, and we totally disagree. But herein lies the reason I find Jesus so absolutely remarkable in this scene. And it's because he simply accepts the gift. He accepts the gift. Absolutely astounding. And you know why I think he accepted it? I think he accepted it because he knew who he was, and he knew that he was worthy of the gift. Let me say that again. Because he knew who he was and that he was worthy of the gift. You see, Jesus is so secure in who he is. He's so secure in his identity that receiving a gift of love, even in the presence of these faulty opinions and judgments, he's still able to welcome that. And let me put this into perspective a little bit. What did he not do in that moment that he could have done? Oh, no, no, Mary. That's just too expensive. I can't receive that. You know what? We're good. We're good. You don't have to do that. He didn't say, all right, I got the check next time, like some of us do sometimes when people offer us, you know, to pay for a meal or something. Jesus didn't say, okay, but then the gifts from you were done forever. Like, you don't have to give me anything else for my birthday, for Christmas, for just because, for graduation. Like, Mary, we're good. Never again do you have to give me a gift. And honestly, I would probably have a response like that. Like, okay, let's just make an agreement right down. We're done for life. Or he didn't say, oh, wow, I don't know how to repay you. How about I give you a mansion in glory someday? He didn't say that either. No indication that he is thinking that he has to owe Mary anything or that he's going to be in her debt. Jesus simply just accepted the gift. And he, you know what? He wasn't rattled by his naysayers either. And I also marvel at his words when he said, "You won't always have me." And I think that's a rather bold statement. He's not dismissing the poor. He's not saying that that's not important to give to the poor. But what I think the greater thing that he's saying there is he's saying, "Hey, everybody, I matter. I matter. And my time is short." So here we see that in the life of Jesus, he doesn't just teach us how to love people. He also teaches us how to receive it from others. And so let me ask you a question today. How are you doing at receiving love and kindness lately? How are you doing at receiving love and kindness lately? Some may say, "Oh, Lisa, this is so different. Jesus, he's Jesus. Like, he's worthy. He's worthy of worship. That's not us." You know what? You're right. We're not worthy of worship. But let me ask you this. Aren't you worthy of love? Aren't you worthy of receiving love and kindness? I can't tell you how many men and women I have sat with through the years. I have listened to their stories, or I have watched them struggle with this very core question. Am I worthy of receiving love? And instead, to see them buried by just a bunch of worldly standards of lovability. And I think we know what they are, right? These standards of, well, I got to be pretty enough. I got to be good enough. I have to be smart enough. I have to be smooth enough. I have to be popular enough. I have to be funny enough. I have to, fill in the blank. What is that? How do you fill in the blank? Maybe some say, "I've made too many mistakes," or I'm too awkward," or "Do you see how I look? Have you met my family?" Just a million reasons why we make that we're not worthy of love. Or, "I don't know how to do friendships." Or here's one: "Lisa, if you really knew who I was, if you really knew me, if you really knew my past, you'd run hard in the other direction and you wouldn't stick around." I've seen that before. I've heard that before. Maybe you're someone who's sitting here today and you think, "You know what? I actually think that I do relationships well. I think that I'm able to give and receive kindness well." And so to you, I say, that's amazing. Continue to model that to the people around you. But how about I get super practical? How are we doing at accepting compliments? Because that's a way of receiving kindness. Ladies, let's get real. How many of you, if you receive a compliment, maybe on a shirt or an accessory or something, your first response is to tell them where you got it and how much you paid for it? I hear some giggles because it's true. "Oh, well, you know, I got this at Target for $15. Or how about in the work environment or students, maybe in school, someone compliments you on a paper or a presentation or a project that you happen to do really well on, and you hear them compliment you, and your immediate response is, "I actually don't think it was that good. I wish I would have done this, and better, and it's kind of subpar performance." Or do we have any athletes in here? Performers or musicians, where you just got done, you know, performing something or a game, and someone comes up and says, "Hey, way to play out there. You worked hard," or "I loved your attitude," or "That was just fantastic." And you just kind of shrug it off, and you say, "It was okay. It wasn't my best. I wish I would have blah, blah, blah." Why do we do that? Why is it so hard to simply receive a compliment without giving any commentary? And I wonder if it's because suddenly we feel seen. in that moment. And we're like, ah, I'm uncomfortable, so I need to divert attention. I need to maybe dismiss it or minimize it and just take it away, because the thought of being acknowledged for any kind of goodness or beauty or approval in me makes me feel deeply uncomfortable. But can we grow in this? Can we look at someone who's just given us a compliment and say, thank you? And just smile, say thank you. Or wow, that made my day. Or appreciate you taking time to say something. And just receive it. Seeing, receiving gifts in many ways is very vulnerable. Because deep down, I think it tells us something about ourselves, and it tells us something about how we perceive our worth and our value. And that territory for us can be very scary, and it can be very sensitive. Do we honestly believe that we are worthy of love and kindness? Because how we answer that question determines how we're able to receive it from other people and to receive it like Jesus received it. In our story today, Jesus shows us what it's like to accept love and kindness without any kind of self-consciousness or insecurity. We watch how we receive the lavish gift in the presence of other people, and we also watch how he did that. He shows us what it's like to just gratefully receive a gift. And then he says, listen now, and then he says, now I want you to receive something from me in that way. Let me say that again. Jesus shows us what it's like to gratefully receive, and then he says, now I want you to receive something from me in the same way. Watch this. So you have the alabaster jar that's been broken and poured out for Jesus. Then you have the body of Jesus broken and poured out for you. You see, Mary's gift points us to the ultimate gift that we have in Jesus. The alabaster jar broken and poured out, the body of Jesus broken and poured out. So how are we doing at receiving the gift of Jesus himself and actually living it out? A few examples of this. The body of Jesus broken and poured out to remind you that you have been forgiven, restored, and set free. Again, it is simply a gift to receive. And some of you may say, I've heard that. I received Jesus' gift. I trust in him. I attend church. You know, I've done that. Well, let me ask you, how are you doing at truly experiencing that freedom that it affords you? How are you doing at experiencing that? Or are you still stuck? Are you still stuck in places of insecurities? Are you still stuck in places of deep shame from the past or the present that in essence is saying, Jesus, I don't think that the cross was big enough for that. And that's not his heart, and that's not true at all. The cross is big enough. The cross is big enough. Maybe we say there's a pain that I've kept hidden for so long, and there are these places of freedom that I'm just still not living out. And let me tell you something, the reality of living out the gift that Jesus has given us in the cross and what's been accomplished is for us every day, and it's something that we need to continually live out every day for the rest of our life. Because the finished work of the cross provides something for you that you cannot do for yourself. The finished work of the cross provides something for you that you cannot do for yourself, and that is called grace. That is called grace, and that is something that we need every day. Another example, the body of Jesus broken and poured out for you to remind you that whatever you do, whether a whole lot of good stuff that you're racking up, or whether a whole lot of bad stuff that you're racking up, let me tell you something. Your behavior does not determine how valuable you are or how worthy you are of love. But you know what? We all play that game. We all play that game. At the end of the day, we assess. the good and the bad, how we feel. And somehow we make up this really distorted equation that our behavior determines our love and our value instead of what Jesus says is true about us. So consciously or subconsciously, you may be constantly asking your question, what do I have to do or not do to demonstrate that I'm worthy of love? And the cross says that it's finished. You do not have to perform, please, or prove to show that you're worthy of love. You do not have to perform, please, or prove to show that you're worthy of love. Church, let's be a people who demonstrate to the world that as humans we are worthy of goodness, we're worthy of kindness, and we're worthy of love because of what Jesus has offered to us, because he gave himself up for us. And let me say this too. This isn't something that just happens. Maybe as you're sitting there, some stuff has been stirred up. And this is a process. It's a process of learning. And to think about my friend, you know, we continue to be friends. I'm friends with her to this day. It took her years for us to walk with her for years to begin to understand that I'm truly worthy of friendship, because no amount of sermons, attending church, Bible verses, sometimes cut it for someone to truly believe it. What do they have to see? They have to see it lived out in the flesh around them. They have to learn to experience it and to watch it happen and to know how it works. And that takes time. And for my friend, I remember the first time I was at her house helping her with some things, and I just yelled back, "We love you." And she had no idea what to do with that. It just kind of bounced off her. She didn't know what to do with that. And so those kinds of things take time. It takes time for that truth to begin to take root in someone's heart and actually manifest to reality. By the way, I reached out to her this week and I said, "Hey, you remember that party 7 years ago? Could I share that story?" And she texted back and she actually had the letter and she sent it to me. I said, "What do you remember about the party?" And she says, "I remember it was just surreal." She says, "And I remember I went because I heard there was cake." Don't underestimate the power of cake. Yes, so that's what got her to the party, was she just heard there was going to be cake there. And I'm happy to say that her cancer is gone today, but she is still going through a lot of health issues. But I'm so grateful that we're still friends. Men and women and students, we deeply matter to Jesus. We deeply matter to Jesus. And he went to the cross for us, not out of duty, but out of joy. He went out of joy. And that brings me to our series title, "For the Joy Set Before Him." That phrase is actually couched in one of my favorite verses in Hebrews 12:2, and it says this: "Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set before him," which is all of us, humanity, "who for the joy set before him," what did he do? "He endured the cross, despising its shame, and he sat down on the right hand throne of the Father." He endured the cross on our behalf, and he took the shame of the world, past, present, and future, and he sat down in a place of all authority and power, because he, Jesus, is the one who says, "You are worthy, and you are worthy of receiving love and good gifts." And so I want to invite us this week to just pray this prayer. And the prayer is this: "Jesus, help me to know and receive your loving gifts in deeper ways." And that might involve being aware of things that keep you from receiving it and saying, "Jesus, help me to let go of whatever that is. Jesus, help me to know and receive your loving gifts in deeper ways." And you know what? It might be a journey for all of us to grow in that, most likely. God's been teaching me a lot about receiving gifts. Some of you know that I've had this journey of back pain, and people, you are so kind. This church is extremely generous and thoughtful, overwhelmingly so, and it's been hard for me to receive all your kindness. And so this has been something that I've been living out myself in the last several weeks of just learning to say thank you. And you know what? That would be nice. I appreciate the meal. And thank you for driving me to my appointment. Thank you for sitting with me at the doctor's office. All these things, these gestures of kindness, to just simply say thank you and to receive them. Jesus was able to receive that gift from Mary because he knew who he was and he knew he was worthy of that. And so as we are being formed more and more into the likeness of Jesus, may the reality of who we are in Christ and the reality that we are worthy in his sight make us more and more capable to receive the good gifts that he wants for us, his kids. Let me pray. Jesus, I thank you for the model that you are and you were of someone that was so secure in who he was, that he was able to receive sometimes very simple acts of kindness from those around you and sometimes very lavish, generous gifts. Thank you for the model that you knew exactly who you were as the Son of God, that you didn't have to pretend or pose or prove. You just were you. And God, I ask that you would form us as a church into people more and more who have the capability to receive from you the love that has been afforded on the cross, the forgiveness, the freedom, all of it. God, that we would embody that, that it would change us, and in essence, we'd be able to share that with other people. Increase our ability to know and receive your loving gifts in deeper ways, and increase our ability to actually be seen as worthy without any of the extra worldly stuff we sometimes try to attach to it. And we thank you that you are so kind and so patient and gentle with us as we learn. And I ask all these things in your name.